Hello, I'm Paul Scott, and today I'm talking to Sosandar, listed on the AIM Stock Exchange, ticker SOS. And I've got on the line the joint CEO, Julie Lavington, and the head of finance, James Bowling. So hello, Julie and James.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Right, okay, I've got to do the quick disclaimers first. I'm not charging a fee for this interview, as usual, and I do hold shares in the company. Okay, let's get started then. So I think most listeners will know what Sosandar does, but could you give us a brief description of the company?
Yes, I can. So just to give you a very small bit of background, if anyone's listening that doesn't know the background to the business. So we're a women's fashion e-commerce business. We launched in September 2016, so we're just over 2 years old. Founders are myself and my business partner, Ali Hall. Our background is we launched and ran Look magazine together, which was the UK's biggest selling fashion magazine. And we ran that business together for 10 years. It was a multi-million pound digital and print business. And we also produced a wide variety of fashion ranges with a number of high street retailers. And it was while we were doing those fashion ranges that we spotted an opportunity in the market for what was to become Sosandar. So to cut a long story short, we left our jobs in corporate life just over 3 years ago, and we launched the business. So basically, Sosandar targets a generation of women who've graduated from throwaway fast fashion, and they want trend-led, quality, affordable clothing. So it's an underserved market of women that we identified who were very frustrated with what's out there. Either clothing's too young for them, or it's a little bit older and a little bit safe and too frumpy. So we produce all our own garments. Everything's a unique design, and it's all sold on our own website.
Okay, great. And you listed through a reversing into a cash shell, didn't you? Well, let me think. Was that in 2017? I'm struggling to remember.
Yeah, November 17.
November 17, okay. And, I mean, at that point, the revenues were negligible almost, weren't they? But since then, the trading, I mean, these are all published figures. Your revenues are currently forecast for 4.35 million this year, which has been raised, that forecast, about three or four times at least, I think. So the sales side of things and the gross margins are both growing like a train, amazing. But the losses seem to have been as originally planned, around 3.5 million forecast loss for this year. So could you explain why it is that the losses are not narrowing in line with the stellar growth?
Yeah, so I think as an overall objective, our plan has always been to maximise the levels of customer acquisition that we can obtain, working within the resources available to us, and that's always been the plan and the plan that we're executing. So what we're doing is the increased revenue growth that we're getting, we're reinvesting that money into customer acquisition to make sure that we can continue to build that customer database and have a strong community of customers that we can contact and sell the product through. And we believe that by doing that and investing early, it's what will drive the longer term profitabilities and success of the business.
Yeah, I see. Okay, so basically any excess you achieve in terms of gross profit over plan gets recycled into faster and faster growth then, I take it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we've raised money, and the money raised was to go, to really build the brand and drive the customer acquisition. So there's an argument to say that, some people will say that maybe we should go faster into customer acquisition and actually extend the losses in the short term. But what we're doing is trying to balance those factors and the risk and reward metrics on those, make sure that we can acquire customers in a way that is relevant for their kind of payback periods and return on investment. But, we're still really feel that continuing to build a database is of significant importance.
Okay. Let's look at product next then. I'm thinking in terms of asking what are your key differentiators then, because there seem to be so many brands in women's wear targeting a similar age group. So what's different about Sosandar?
So really what differentiates us is this opportunity that Ali and I spotted in the market so what we saw with women was as they were growing up with brands like Topshop and ASOS, which are very fashion-forward, exciting brands that are brilliant for women in their 20s. And then as women started to get a little bit older, moving into their 30s, they started to feel like they were growing out of the fast throwaway fashion brands, but what they wanted is they wanted a brand that was just as fashionable as those younger fast fashion brands, but they wanted more quality clothing. They still wanted the clothing to be affordable and they still wanted high fashion, but they wanted things that were a little bit more age appropriate, so more suitable to wear for work. So with Sosandar, we have really high fashionable product, but the lengths on the skirts and dresses are more varied lengths. They're all not really short, so you won't get skirts that are up your backside. Pardon my French with Sosandar. They're much more suitable for going to work. They're kind of chic but sexy. Mm-hmm. We do a very wide range of products, so we cover all occasions, all events. So we do dresses, skirts, outerwear, footwear. But it's all so it's all very fashionable, but it's basically it fits real women's bodies. So they're all very flattering to women's bodies, as well as being very, very fashionable at the forefront of fashion. And that's really what differentiates us. So at the other end, what we were finding with women is that they were often, when they were growing up through these younger fast fashion brands, then they were kind of then transitioning really into either very expensive brands, and they didn't suddenly want to spend £200 or £250 on a dress, or they were finding brands that were possibly a little bit too safe and in some cases a little bit frumpy for them. They still wanted very fashionable clothes, and so Sosandar's really filling that gap in between the younger fast fashion brands and then the slightly safer older brands, or the brands that are more affordable.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of high street competitors then, could you give us a few names of brands that are closest to you? I mean, what about Next? Would that be similar in a way?
In terms of, obviously, Next has got a very wide customer demographic. So, yes, I think the reality is that the women that we're attracting are going to be shopping everywhere and anywhere. And yeah, what we found is that women in our demographic and the customers that we're targeting, they're struggling to identify and connect emotionally with any one particular brand. So they might be shopping anywhere from Topshop to Zara to ASOS to Next to Debenhams to Marks and Spencers, but there wasn't that one brand that they was their natural go-to place, was the first place that they turned to, that they were really emotionally connecting with. So I think the way I'd describe it is, if for a typical like woman in her 20s, often the first place she might think of going to for any occasion might be ASOS, for example. Mm-hmm. So first place she'd go and look, and there isn't that one black brand that our customers were going to. And so our vision for Sosandar is to be that very first place that our customers think of, no matter what the occasion. And that's the vision to build Sosandar into.
Okay, great. Let's jump ahead and just think about celebrity influencers and endorsements. So I know this has been a key sort of strategy for you. And anyone who looks into it will see that there have been an amazing number of celebrity endorsements for Sosandar. So do you pay these celebrities to wear your clothes?
No, we don't pay the celebrities. We don't have commercial relationships with them, and that's purposefully we don't have commercial relationships with them. So our strategy with celebrities, that's part of our marketing strategy. So we kind of have a four-pronged approach, I would say. So we use social media, we use PR, which is celebrities, and newspapers and TV. We use direct mail and we use email marketing. So with celebrities, it's always been our strategy to target a really broad cross-section of celebrities. So the age demographic of Sosandar is quite broad. So we are attracting women from, you know, late 20s right through to women in their 60s. And with celebrities, we do exactly the same thing. We target a really broad cross-section of ages and also different styles. You know, the celebrities we target wear different styles of clothes. So the reason for doing that is we want to ensure that Sosandar's got really wide appeal. So that's why we engage with so many different types of celebrities, so that lots of different women will associate with the celebrities that we're targeting. So what we do is we gift the clothing to them, but we don't pay them to endorse the product. So it's entirely up to them if they wear the product, and entirely up to them if they post themselves wearing the product.
Mm.
And the reason we do that is we want it to be authentic, and we want celebrities and influencers as well to be wearing our clothes because they really want to wear our clothes. And I think that's what's been so brilliant about this is celebrities are wearing Sosandar clothing multiple times because they want to wear Sosandar clothing. Mm. So what we found is that in the same way that we identified a whole host of customers who were very frustrated with what's out there currently, and they were struggling to find the clothing that they really wanted, we've kind of hit that niche, I think, as well with celebrities who also need multiple clothes to wear, of clothing that's very appropriate for their lifestyles, but the clothing that's also very, very fashionable.
Yeah, okay. So in terms of how important the celebrity endorsements are, does it always stimulate demand for a particular product, or is it just certain celebrities who trigger an increase in sales?
All sorts of different celebrities work in different ways, I think, with different segments of our audience. Some celebrities might drive more sales than others, but there's not necessarily any consistency. Most of the time, influencers and celebrities will work to a lesser or greater degree to drive sales. And it's probably also important to say, you know, we're not just engaging with celebrities to drive sales of that particular garment. It's about building brand credibility and about third parties wearing our clothes so that we start to build awareness of the Sosandar brand. So it's more than just selling that garment that they're wearing. It is about building brand awareness, building credibility that other famous people are wearing the brand. And it works incredibly well, because when women see celebrities wearing the brand that they are wearing, it makes them, you know, want our brand even more.
Yeah. And has your fashion magazine experience and contacts helped in this regard? Because you seem to be punching considerably above your weight, in a way, in terms of the size of the company, of the quantity and quality of celebrity endorsements you're achieving.
Yes, I think it did. I think from the word go, the fact that we came from the media meant that we took PR incredibly seriously. And by PR, I mean everything from TV, newspapers, magazines, digital media, celebrities and influencers. It's always been a very, very important part of our strategy. And from the minute Sosandar launched, we were getting extensive coverage in all newspapers and magazines, to a degree because we knew a certain element of the press and we had contacts in the press. But I think more than that is we knew and understood how to give them what they needed in order that they would cover Sosandar. And because we built that credibility in the beginning, I think, through the media, that then got celebrities started to see our clothes in the national press and on TV. And so it's kind of been a bit of a snowball effect. And we did, you know, we knew exactly how to target celebrities and how to work with their stylists. We knew how to build relationships. We knew what to do, I suppose.
Yeah, because that's interesting, because a skeptic about Sosandar shares, who's a friend of mine who's a fund manager, sort of swatted this point away when I mentioned it to him and said, well, they're all these fashion websites are doing that. So is that not a valid comeback?
I think fashion brands working with celebrities has been done set forever. And it is done by lots and lots of different brands, and it's always incredibly successful. I think what's different about us is usually a small brand like ours, they would start off by paying a celebrity because they wouldn't necessarily know how to go about building relationships with multiple celebrities, nor would it necessarily be their strategy. So they would begin by probably paying a celebrity. We didn't want to do that because we felt that to pay a celebrity meant that you are narrowing the appeal of your brand, because not all women are going to necessarily engage with that one particular celebrity. I think the broad cross-section of celebrities that we've engaged with is quite exceptional and is unheard of for a brand of, you know, our size, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the key point, isn't it? You're still a very small business, but your PR and celebrity endorsements, you look like a big company because you're getting such wide coverage. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Thank you. I was just going to say, it's a trading channel for us. We measure the return on investments of it. So whilst a lot of people can do it, doesn't mean that they can do it well and make it commercial. And I think that's one of the things that we've been really successful with.
Yeah, okay. Let's segue into talking about social media then. I mean, that's absolutely key these days, isn't it? I mean, I know one of the readers flagged up to me that there are some quite damaging reviews on Facebook and Mumsnet, and one of my readers said that his wife liked the look of your garments but decided not to order because there was a lot of criticism about delays in getting refunds on returns on Mumsnet. So, I mean, how do you handle the whole social media and the feedback side, review side of things?
So social media is incredibly important to us and has been a very important platform. Even before we started selling clothes, we already had we were publishing content on Facebook for 6 months before we even started selling clothes. And we have an exceptionally good following and really strong community on both Facebook and Instagram. And so I guess really social media is like our shop window. So it's our ever open virtual shop window. So we're constantly posting all our new products, celebrities wearing our clothes, really engaging and interesting content. And what we find now is we get, obviously you mentioned the occasional piece of criticism, which naturally any brand is going to get some criticism. By far and away, 99% of what you will find on social media will be positive comments about Sosandar. And the brilliant thing is that we, as the brand now is starting to get bigger and bigger and people who know about the brand is increasing, we find people answering each other's questions. So, for example, somebody might say under a post on Sosandar, oh, has anybody bought from this brand? What's the sizing like? And rather than us as a brand having to answer that, somebody else will jump in and say, oh, yeah, I've bought from this brand several times. It's really brilliant. The quality's great. And I'm a standard size 12 and I buy a size 12. So you kind of get people interacting with each other, complete strangers interacting on Facebook or Instagram talking about the brand. And as I say, 99.9% of the time it will be very positive. Obviously, any negative comments that we get, we will always deal with and follow up any negative comments at all.
Okay. And then just to look at another key feature of the business, which I like, which is the rapid stock turn and your speed to market and this test and repeat business model. I mean, you achieved sales growth of 407% year on year in the most recent interim results, obviously coming from a low base. But I noticed that inventories only went up 42%. So how was that achieved? And do you want to talk more widely about this topic?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, in terms of that, as most things with this business, it comes back to having the right product and, you know, high quality product that people want. So obviously that's the starting point and having effective marketing techniques as well to create that demand. But in terms of sort of specifically, we work really hard in terms of managing our minimum order quantities, so working with the suppliers so that we can operate a test and repeat model. And what that means is that you can back your winners successfully in quick turnaround times, whilst minimising the sort of downside risk on anything that may not work initially. We also work really hard to manage our acquisition spend to match the quantities that we're bringing in to the business. As we better understand the repeat order dynamics of our customers, we can have an estimate of what our base level sales might be and work our order quantities to that. We can then overlay the acquisition activity to really make sure that we're buying the right amount of product to meet customer demands. There's also a raft of things that we do on the website, and probably one of the most successful things that we've done is the waitlist functionality. So that means that people, if the product isn't immediately available, people can sign up to the waitlist functionality, and as soon as the product comes back into stock, they're notified by email that the product is available, and that has had a significant improvement in our sell-through rates, helping to achieve those metrics that you just outlined.
Okay. So if something goes onto the website and you launch it and it starts flying out with customers just buying it quicker, so you know you've got a winner on your hands then. So how quickly can you then respond? Do you sort of look at the sales on a weekly basis and then decide to put in a repeat order?
We look at sales on a minute-by-minute basis or hour-by-hour basis.
Yeah.
We can reorder styles within about 4 weeks. So, and this is something that we've had great success in bringing down that reorder time since we launched 2.5 years ago. So we're very, very happy now with the fact that we can get stock back in within 4 weeks. So we are, Sosandar's now operating on much more of a fast fashion type business model, meaning that we're designing very close to season, which means that we can react very well to customer demand and to trends, and then reordering very quickly. But the quality of our product is incredibly high.
Yeah, so you're going to be so much more responsive to customer demand than a bricks and mortar, a large national chain is going to have to plan their products months and months ahead, aren't they?
Whereas
so much more nimble. Yeah. So that's a great aspect of the business model. Looking at the a not so good aspect of the business model, which affects all online retailers, and this certainly seems to be the biggest issue with investors who've contacted me, is the issue of customer returns. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah. So maybe if we just sort of give a bit of explanation about why our customers return and why women return in general, just to sort of set the scene. I think the way we have to look at returns is just an aspect of doing business online. And increasingly, women use their bedroom like they would a changing room. So I think we have to see it in exactly the same way that you would go into a shop, try a ton of stuff on, and then put half of it back on the rail. Women are really doing that now with online shopping. And when they return things, by and large, they're returning things because it just doesn't suit. So we monitor and track very carefully why returns are coming back. So women will try things on and they're returning the things that they don't look as good in as other things. I think the reality with women's clothing is no matter how well or the garment fits or how much effort you put into the garment fitting, the reality is until that garment actually goes on a human being's body and you look in the mirror, you've got no idea what that garment's going to look like on you. So to a degree, it is just a necessary part of doing business. However, that doesn't mean to say that we don't focus very, very carefully on ensuring that returns on any individual garment are as low as they possibly can be from a fit perspective and obviously from a quality perspective. So as a business, we invest very heavily in garment technology, and we have done from the beginning. It's something that's very different about us as a business than the kind of typical fast fashion brands. So we focus a lot on fit, on making sure that the garments fit really well and that there's consistency of fit. And if we spot anything in a particular garment, we will work very carefully on going forward that we eradicate whatever the problem is with that garment to try and to reduce the returns. But I think having said all that, the reality is women want to try loads of clothes on and then return the ones that they don't look as good in as other things.
Yeah,
I think from a financial perspective with returns, what we find is that if you can get the product back into the business and out for resale, then returns in isolation as a metric, it needs to be joined up with looking at things like gross margin and your stock turn. Now, our returns, as soon as they come back in, we don't suffer issues of things like products not being able to go back out for resale. So typically, products come back in, they're booked back into the warehouse, which triggers the waitlist functionality, which then means that customers are repurchasing that product and it's going straight out. So we've already talked about the margins that we've achieved and the stock efficiencies that we've achieved. So looking at returns in isolation is only looking at part of the story, and there are other metrics that are probably more important to focus on when understanding the impact of returns.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I noticed the returns rate was about dropped from 52% to 49% in Q3. So do you have internally a target rate that you'd like to see that get down to where you think is a little plateau, or do we just have to live with it at that sort of level?
It's so product specific. So the logic would dictate that there are a number of factors that would reduce that number. So as an example, we know that returning customers return at a lower rate than acquisition customers. So as our proportion of repeat orders build, you know, logic would dictate that that would reduce it. And there's also, you know, we're monitoring the market. There's a lot of companies, tech companies, things like that, that are suggesting that they can help with return rates. But I think what we focus on is just making sure that we can deliver the right product to the customers with an excellent customer experience. And so from a return or a forecasting perspective, we have some small reductions, but we're confident that we can have a profitable business model, even operating at the return levels that we have. So there's a lot of external factors that we won't be able to control, but we focus on controlling the things that we can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I've been Googling all this business about customer returns online, and it's quite interesting. There seem to be articles online about serial returners, people who just basically like ordering lots of clothes and trying it on, maybe wearing one item out to a party. And then, you know, there was one woman who bought about £20,000 of clothes and returned £19,500 worth of it. And, I mean, have you identified any customers like that, and how do you deal with it? Do you have to ultimately just ban customers who are doing that sort of thing?
I think the data exists within the business for us to be able to analyse that. It's not a behaviour we've seen necessarily within our customer base. You know, to the point I made before, we've not had any problems with product coming back in that we can't put back out for resale. So the data exists for us to analyse that, and it will form part of our customer segmentation as we, you know, increase the use of that. I think, yeah, it's something that you have to be very careful of, because obviously if you offer free returns and it's the cost of doing business, then as long as they're not abusing the system, so the example you gave of someone wearing something and then sending it back, then obviously if we can identify that behaviour, then it's something that we'd address. But it's not something we've experienced to date, but we do have the capabilities to address it if we
okay.
see that.
Okie dokie. Let's move on then. Just go through my notes. Oh, let's look at cash and cash burn. So you had 4.6 million net cash at the end of December 2018, and the broker forecast from Shore Capital suggests that's plenty for you to reach break even. There was a top-up placing at 32p last autumn. Can you talk to us a bit more about the placing and why it was done?
Yeah, sure. So at the time, we weren't actively seeking funds, but we were approached by one of our existing investors offering funds at a significant premium on the November 17 raise. Generally, the decision was taken, you know, it wasn't taken lightly, but we just felt that having that additional resource to support the continued growth was advantageous. And the other thing was the speed in which the deal was completed. So as still a relatively small team, what it meant was that there was very limited time out of the business to get funds into the business. So we were able to really focus attentions on trading. And, you know, looking back, it does feel like it was the right decision.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I misunderstood it at the time, I must admit. I'm embarrassed to admit. Because I think one of the things was that when I think it said in the RNS that the money had been raised due to institutional demand, those particular words, institutional demands, most private investors normally scoff at, because it's normally a fig leaf to say that actually directors wanted to dump some of their own shares, but they claim it was institutional demand. But in this case, that's not correct at all. This was genuine institutions came to you, didn't you, and offered you money.
Exactly.
Unsolicited.
And as we understand, that's quite rare.
So,
you know, it was something that we you know, it came to the business, and we made some quick, you know, we assessed it very quickly, decided to do it, and got it done quickly. So I think to be able to have those funds with minimal time out of the business was really positive.
Yes, I agree. And the other thing is market conditions have really tightened up in the last few months. My broker tells me that institutions in many cases are now just not interested in funding the smallest companies. So I think it was very wise of you to sort of get a bit extra in the pot when the going, you know, in terms of the city's appetite for fundraisings was high. So, yeah, very positive, I think. Okay, now one of the readers asks about quarterly cash burn. This is relating to October to December, which is your financial year's Q3, calendar Q4. They ask, given that October to December's by far your biggest seasonal patch for sales, why was it that the cash burn actually increased to, I think, about 900,000 roughly in Q3?
Yeah, so I think as a business, what we do around our customer acquisition is we invest funds when we get the greatest return on investment. So that was Q3 is a key trading quarter for us, but it was also the quarter where we invested heavily, the most in customer acquisition, because for every pound you spend in that quarter, you get a better return than in other quarters when trade, you know, the market is a bit softer. So that our cash flows will not be kind of steady and even. They will be linked to, you know, the periods where we invest into customer acquisition. And the from a cash flow perspective, that quarter we had 3 months of direct mail investment, not necessarily from a P&L perspective, but, you know, from a cash flow perspective with the delayed payment terms that we get. You know, that was the main contributor to the cash burn in that quarter.
So what you're saying, you spend on the marketing spend and the PR, and then there's a delayed payback in terms of customers actually buying stuff. Is that right?
Absolutely. So, you know, as with most growing e-commerce businesses, you invest in that upfront acquisition. Doesn't necessarily pay back in the first order, but what you're doing is you're building the customer database that you can advertise to for free through email or through, you know, the direct channels that we get the repeat business through, and they don't necessarily cost you anything. So what it does is that if you build, you know, coming back to the opening point I made, we want to invest in customer acquisition in a way that's efficient from a cost of acquisition perspective, but we want to build that customer database so that we can market to them when in the subsequent trading months, and you know it's that will drive the future profitability. So you know, and we see the increase in returns from our marketing spend as we've grown.
Yeah, because I think probably, I mean, there are several KPIs that I really like about this business, because I'm not pretending to be neutral here. I'm a very, very enthusiastic shareholder in the company. So, I mean, the conversion rate increased considerably to almost 3.5%, average order values over £100, gross profit margin 53% to 55% is amazing for the size of company, I think. But probably the statistic I like the best is the repeat order stuff. Now, you said, I think in the December update, you said repeat orders up 527% to 20,000 orders. Well, that was more than half of the total orders for the quarter, wasn't it? So it looks like you're getting tremendous traction with customers who are coming back and buying more stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think we're absolutely delighted with the repeat order rates that we're getting. And that's exactly what we've set out to do, acquire the customers, knowing that they will come back. And the reason we're getting such brilliant traction, I think, is it's obviously brilliant product in the first place. So the absolute fundamentals of this business is the product has to be right.
Yeah.
And the product is so strong, it's making people want to come back for more and more. And then it's combining that product with really brilliant marketing. So it's marketing that's engaging with our customers, brilliant imagery that's making people want to buy the product. And it's a combination of everything right across the business that is making people come back more and more to Sosandar.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, I was at a capital markets day for a software company unrelated to fashion, but they were giving out some interesting stats there, and they were saying that you can work out the lifetime value of a client in terms of the profit you think you'll make from an average client over that lifetime value, and then you can compare that with the cost of acquisition of each active client, or maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's an average of all clients, and then you divide one by the other, and apparently over 7 times lifetime value over customer acquisition cost. Apparently that is that's a good metric. So, I mean, have you got any data on that?
I think, you know, lifetime value is something that we'll continue to build our models on and test, but with only 2 years of data, it's very difficult to actually know what the lifetime value of a customer is, because so much of our acquisition has actually taken place in the last sort of 12 to 16 months. So for a lot of customers, we don't even have a full year of trading history. But the thing we're excited about on a lifetime value is the, you know, Julie touched upon before, the range of our customer demographics. So we're getting people from 20s to 60s. So we don't necessarily have a cliff of a customer sort of falling out of our database. So we're really excited for the lifetime value, because we feel like we can, you know, acquire a customer and have them for life.
Yeah, well, I mean, I noticed on one of the slides on your last presentation pack that I looked at that last night again, and the core demographic of 35 to 55 is actually only about half of your total sales. I was amazed to see that the either side, particularly actually on the older side, people going up to the 65, is a major part of your sales as well. I mean, has that surprised you?
I think we probably expected it. We always knew that we wanted to be clear that we were setting out to target women in their 30s, 40s and 50s. So 35 to 54 is what we how we described the women that we were targeting. But we always knew that this was really much more about an attitude rather than an age. And I guess we put an age on it to a degree to explain to people what we were targeting, because if we didn't put an age on it, it was very difficult to communicate what we were doing with Sosandar. The reality is what we're targeting is an attitude, which is basically women, as they are getting older, are no longer getting older in their heads, and they're not behaving old. And actually, it's not just women, it's society in general, men as well. You know, as a society, we're becoming a kind of ageless society, I suppose, and people aren't behaving in their 50s, 60s and 70s how they used to behave, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And, you know, people in their 60s and 70s are leading lifestyles that probably people in their 30s used to lead. And I think that's what really we're seeing with Sosandar is people want to wear very fashionable clothing no matter what their age, because they don't feel their age, and age doesn't really mean anything. It's just a number. So it is, you know, we are attracting women in their 20s and women in their 60s, and they will wear similar types of clothing.
So the lifetime of one of your customers could be 40 years if as long as you don't
Absolutely.
Upset
yeah.
if as long
yeah.
as you don't upset
Absolutely.
Them somewhere along the way. I blame Jennifer Saunders and what's she called on Absolutely Fabulous. I think they triggered this change in society. It's all good fun, though. Great stuff. We probably better get on to some reader questions, haven't we? We had loads of them. So can we do sort of quick-fire answers on these so we can fit in as many as possible?
Yeah.
Grayster asks about Clipper Logistics. Are you over-reliant on them?
I mean, they're our logistic provider, so you know, we had to pick one, and we're super happy with how they perform. So they are absolute best in class. You know, they have SLAs in their contract, which on the face of them are really strict, but they continue to outperform all of those metrics, and we couldn't be happier with them, really. But obviously, having said that, we are aware of the alternative providers, and, you know, we understand the need to understand the market, but we couldn't be happier with Clipper.
Well, that's good news. Yeah, I took the opportunity to have a look at their last set of accounts as well, just to double check for myself. And it hasn't got the strongest of balance sheets, I've got to say, but it looks fine. You know, it's a solid, profitable, cash generative business. So I think it looks pretty safe to me. And of course, it's stock market listed, so people can follow its performance as well. These are all just jumping about a bit on different themes, but Pippa's fan asks about, she says, your catalogue looks super, however it seems overburdened by animal print fashions. How well is it selling?
I love this question. the answer is, in a nutshell, absolutely brilliantly. Women love animal print. So the reason there's so much animal print at the moment is animal print just happens to be very, very fashionable at the moment. And you know, it won't be very, very fashionable forever. Something else will be very, very fashionable in the future. But what we do at Sosandra is we are all about catering for customer demand and understanding exactly what customers want to buy at any given point. And that happens to be animal print at the minute, which is why there is so much of it.
Yeah, so you're not forcing the pace on it. You're just responding to what the customers want, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Because so much of what we do is test and repeat. We test. You know, we'll test new things, see how they respond, and then repeat on them. And every time we do anything new in animal print, it flies out the door.
Interesting. The other thing I do, I look at your website every day, and I look at each the individual styles, and I can start to see when the crosses come up, where they've sold out. And so I can deduce from that what's selling well and what isn't. And so people can check that for themselves by looking on your website, investors can. So, the next one, someone called Snoo, these are all obviously the pseudonyms that people use online, has asked about the importance of Julian Alley, saying, is the company over-reliant on the two of you and your insights and experience and knowledge and so on?
So, obviously, we're the ones that started the business and we're the founders of the business and the driving force behind the business, and we identified the gap in the market, which I think we're proving out. But at the same time, we are building a very, very strong team of people around us, and it's our job, not just to be the ones leading the business. We have to build a very strong team around us. We're recruiting really excellent people, and I think we're surrounded by great people who also absolutely understand and identify with the opportunity that we've identified, and we're instilling, the brand and our ethos into them.
Yeah.
So yes, of course we're important, but we're not, the team is also the business.
Yeah, and I mean, with companies at this market size, about 32 million market cap, it's inevitable that the founders are going to be key players, isn't it, really? Can't get around that.
No.
Okay, Loughton asks about broker research. Saying, would you consider using another broker who will make their research freely available to private investors? After all, you're paying for the research, and Shore Capital just seem to sort of give it out privately to their clients and hold it back from the private investors who are actually the people who are trading the shares in the market. So what's your feeling on that?
I mean, we've been to a lot of sort of private investor events, and we're aware of the feedback that we get, and so we're just continuing to try and working to try and provide a solution that works for both their needs and for the needs of the business, and balancing those. So it's, we're aware of that requirement, and it's on our agenda.
Yeah, great. And I must admit, you've been very open and very investor friendly in terms of getting along to investor shows and doing, investor meetings and so on, which I think people really appreciate. And I note as well, when you appeared at the UK Investor Show last year, I think the share price had dropped to about 11 or 12p. And within a few weeks of the show, I think your presentations went down very, very well. People have doubled their money, so that was a great start. So all good. We've covered that one. Next one, we've covered competitors as well. Oh, menswear. Someone called DJCP just asked about menswear. Said obviously your expertise is in womenswear, but given that menswear, has a much lower returns rate and men don't tend to send things back as much and so on, is that possibly an area to consider for the future?
I think there are loads of opportunities, because what we're doing with Sosandar is building a brand, not just selling clothes. So there are opportunities to do menswear, kidswear, homes. I think all are potential for the future. For now, we've barely scratched the surface, I think, and the business is still very much in its early stages. Mm. So there's still a huge opportunity to grow in women's wear, but we are absolutely open to expanding into other areas as the business scales up.
Yeah, and I know companies like, say, for example, French Connection, actually do the whole lifestyle brand thing, and they make more money from the licensing revenues on products like perfume, branded glass, spectacles, and so on, than they do actually from, well, they lose money on the retail side of things.
Yeah.
I mean, is that are you sort of tuned into those potential opportunities further forward then, in terms of maybe franchise deals and licensing?
I think with a business like this, you've always got to be open to everything and always investigate all opportunities and make the right, make the right decisions as the business goes along, I think, and never close anything down. Always investigate everything, be open, look at the pros and cons, and then make a decision about what's in the best interest of the business and the shareholders.
But I think all of those opportunities would come from building a strong brand, and that's what we're relentlessly focused on at the moment.
So all that sort of thing's realistically a few years out, isn't it? But on the agenda longer term, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds sensible. Now, Zipman Peter, I don't know if you can answer this, but he said, what's their split of admin expenses into marketing, distribution, fulfillment, and other?
So that isn't something that is currently split out in the publicly available information. What we can say is, marketing is our biggest area of cost, but it's also the area where we've seen the biggest efficiencies, as both in the cost of acquisition, but equally in the growing repeat numbers that we've seen, and that really starts to drive efficiencies as the business grows. In terms of the other areas, distribution, we use Clipper, so we benefit from their expertise in logistics, and that helps make sure that cost is controlled. From an other overhead perspective, the team has grown in the past 12 months, but it's not something that will continue to grow at the same rate. So the important thing, I think, is that we're seeing improvements across all areas.
Yeah, okay. The other thing I like about the business model with online is that this is similar to other online retailers I've looked at. The big marketing spend is discretionary, isn't it? You can switch that off, but you could drastically reduce that if you wanted to. Which means really the profit figure and cash burn really are just numbers that you can dial up to whatever you want to a certain extent, aren't they? Is that a fair comment?
It is, yeah, and it comes back to that point of, right at the start where you asked about the losses. So our focus is to use our available resources to maximise the number of customers we can acquire, because we're confident in the repeat order metrics, and obviously with our beneficial average order values and gross profit, we think it's the right thing to do to continue to invest.
I agree. Then this is a slightly odd one. Radioactive Man asks, if there was a wave of retail failures hitting the high street, which I think it pretty much is, what if any would be the impact on Sosandar?
I think what we do really with our businesses, we just focus on what the customer wants and keep delivering to what the customers want. And if we do that, then we'll build long-term success for the business. So it's difficult to say whether, as long as we keep doing that as Sosandar, then and focus on what we're doing, then that what's happening in the high street, while we look at it, and obviously we're very aware of how other brands are doing, what's happening in the wider world, and understanding that, we just need to focus on building Sosandar and our own business.
So I suppose if there were a wave of retail failures, I mean, Debenhams is very much in the news at the moment, announced today a sort of almost emergency extension of its bank borrowings. Some sort of restructuring involving store closures looks likely there, and, of course, already House of Fraser. So could that trigger... I mean, I'm just thinking that could be well, positive for you in terms of giving you more market share, but negative in terms of prices, as so they sort of liquidate stock at half price or 75% off. Does that ring true to you?
I think I do understand exactly what you mean about the rest of the high street discounting. I think the reality is, since Sosandar launched, we've faced a retail landscape which is very largely driven by discounting and lower prices. Mm. And virtually, you know, the majority of women's fashion brands out there are discounting permanently to a lesser or greater degree. The model for Sosandar, we've gone entirely the opposite way, and what we're doing is not discounting. The only discounting we do is in end of season sale, and we sell product at full price. So we're building a business where women are buying from us because they really want the product, and we think that's been the right strategy, is not to get involved in greater and greater discounts, trying to compete with, you know, a multitude of discounting that's going on out there, because the reality is women will spend the money if they want the product.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on your mailing list, obviously, out of curiosity as a shareholder, and I hardly ever, I'm struggling to think of ever having got an email saying, you know, discount code, use this before midnight, da-da-da-da-da, whereas other fashion retailers, you get that almost on a daily basis. So it's a very, very different approach you're taking, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We decided that it was the right way to go, which was to build a quality brand that where people wanted the product. And because our product's entirely unique, you can't buy it anywhere else. The brand's entirely unique. Women are engaging with it in really major way. They're prepared to spend money. And, you know, Sosandar's not expensive. Our clothing isn't expensive. It's between probably on average about £60 for a dress, £60 to £70 for a dress. It's not expensive, but it's not cheap. You know, we're not selling low-priced garments. We're selling high-quality garments at affordable prices.
Yeah, okay. And somebody asks about ethical fashion as well. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think there are probably three areas that I'd touch upon regarding ethical fashion. The first one really is about... There's an awful lot in the press about fast fashion building up stock mountains. I guess with our model, which is all about quality fashion, not throwaway fashion, what we're doing is building a business where we're constantly bringing in new products and selling through that product very quickly, so we're not building a stock mountain. We reprocess our returns, so the returns go straight back into resale, and the kind of garments that we're selling aren't throwaway garments, they're wash and wear for years type garments, so we're not encouraging that behaviour, which is to, you know, buy it, wear it once and throw it away. So that's one area. Packaging, we're incredibly focused on packaging as well. So our product is all sent out in recyclable boxes with recyclable tissue paper. That box has been wrapped in plastic to make it easy for carrying with a carry handle on it. So we are currently looking at removing the plastic from the outside because we want to reduce the amount of plastic that we've got, and looking at ways of packaging it differently so there is no plastic around the outside. So we're very much focused on that, plus constantly looking at ways that we can reduce plastic around the actual garments as well, and looking at different types of plastic that we could use, and we're talking to Clipper currently about any ways at all that we can basically reduce plastic in all our packaging. And then
thirdly, because you had another point coming, so you carry on.
The third thing is about ensuring that our factories are meeting ethical guidelines. So we personally visit all the factories, we have personal relationships with the factories, and we think that, you know, at our stage of business, that's the best way that we can go about ensuring that we that our factories are running to ethical guidelines and they're paying their workers fairly, and that workers are working in good surroundings and so on.
Yeah, well, that was actually going to be my next question, so we coincided perfectly there. Probably just got time for one or two quick ones before our time's up. Somebody asks about, this is from Martin, he asks about your IT department. So I know that you outsource on a platform called Magento, but does that, what level of customization and management does that require, and do you do that in-house or not?
So in-house we focus on customer experience and customer journey, and we manage that, and then we use our developer to help with those customization features. But I think with a lot of things with Magento, any e-commerce technologies, they generally have plugins, which minimizes the kind of development resource required to actually implement those kind of things.
I think, to be clear, the website, the day-to-day running of the website is all done in-house. The only thing that is outsourced is the back-end development of the website, the actual build and development. So anything that you see on the front end of the website, the imagery, the content, everything about it, all that is done in-house.
I see. Yes. Okay. And is that a big expense, or is it sort of a handful of people? Or
it's done by the marketing and e-commerce team.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah.
So our entire team is 27 people across the whole business at the moment, and about half of those probably fall into marketing and e-commerce.
Okay, brilliant. And just one last question then on international growth. This is from Mojo Mogos. You've got to bear in mind a lot of our questions and male investors who maybe are not that hot on sort of female fashion world, so hence why some of these questions might be a bit basic. But this reader asks about, has got an impression that you're a UK-centric brand and product and doesn't think it will internationalise well. What's your feeling on that?
What we were talking about earlier about society changing and it becoming an ageless society, I think that same phenomenon exists in many countries across the world. So what we see happening in the UK, that's not unique to the UK. So we do see there being huge opportunities to develop Sosandar overseas. So the US, Australia, Europe in particular could be very, very strong markets for us as the business builds. But obviously at this stage, we've still got a very long way to go in the UK with lots of low-hanging fruit in the UK that, we've barely scratched the surface yet. So I think in the immediate future, yes, we're very focused on the UK, but we see an incredible opportunity overseas.
I was just going to say, we're confident that the principles of affordable, trend-led quality products will apply worldwide, and also that the marketing model we've adopted is translatable into worldwide. We could pick it up and do similar strategies there using the test and repeat model. And I think in terms of expansion, there's a huge amount of data now that exists to help with international expansion. So it's something that we're conscious of and have an eye on for the future.
I was going to say, I don't know whether my reader got that impression, but my feeling is that British fashion brands seem to actually work very well abroad. British fashion seems to be sort of quite ahead of countries like Germany and so on. And ASOS and Boohoo and groups like that have expanded overseas very successfully. So I don't see why you shouldn't be able to as well in due course.
Yes, I would agree with that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, our hour is up. Thanks so much for your time, Julie and James. Any sort of closing remarks or final things you want to add that we haven't covered?
I think we've covered most things. I think probably just to finish off by saying that we're incredibly excited about what we've achieved so far with Sosandar, and all the KPIs are trending in the right direction, and we feel incredibly confident going into 2019 and the outlook for the business.
I guess
just thank you as well to everyone, for their ongoing support. So we interact with a lot of people at various shows and we always enjoy it. So
excellent. Well, I mean, certainly my feeling is that, when you listed, when the shares were listed at 15.1p, it was negligible sales. It was really just a punt in the hope that you might achieve the growth that you were setting out from almost a standing start. Whereas where we are now with the shares sort of almost double the IPO price. This is now a business that's developing and is clearly going to succeed. You can see from the growth rate and the workout of numbers on a spreadsheet that the operational gearing is such that this will, this unless you muck up all the fashions completely, of course, which you know, could happen to any fashion company, couldn't it? But assuming you get your fashions right, this business is going to succeed now. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So all great stuff, I think.
Yeah, we certainly agree with that.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for your time, Julie and James. Really enjoyed chatting to you. And maybe we could speak later on in the year, maybe after the final results come out, maybe in the summer or something.
Yeah, perfect.
Smashing. Thanks again, then. Cheerio.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.